This episode is brought to you by WWE Slam Crate. WWE Slam Crate is a bi-monthly subscription box service for the ultimate WWE fan. Every other month, you get 4 to 6 championship-worthy collectibles, including an authentic tee and other officially licensed products, featuring an all-new figure line that debuts with Stone Cold Steve Austin as the first in a 4-figure series. Sign up now at lootcrate.com/MLB and enter code MLBSHOW, that's one word, to save $3 on your subscription. Again, that's lootcrate.com/MLB, code MLB Show. Hello and welcome to the Ringer MLB Show. My name is Ben Lindbergh and I'm a staff writer for TheRinger.com, as is my colleague and co-host Michael Bauman. Hello, Michael.
Yo,
you just wrote something for TheRinger.com, 6 reasons you should watch the World Baseball Classic. The World Baseball Classic starts today, so give us at least a few of your favorite reasons.
The Dutch team is awesome. They've got funny names and weird pitchers and very good infielders.
Okay.
It is a safe way to express your jingoism without veering into dangerous nationalist territories. So okay. This is something that I personally find very useful and therapeutic. Mm-hmm. And like the big thing for me is, and this is to everybody's continuous groaning why I keep bringing up college baseball, it's like there's so much Major League Baseball out there. Part of the comfort of it is that it's there every day, but it's also there every day and it's the same. And this is just a little bit different. This is, you know, different uniforms, slightly different rules, players playing in different combinations. So it's just, it's cool. It's baseball, unlike what we're used to the other 11 months of the year, every 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of American fans maybe look at the WBC as that tournament that they hope that their team's players don't get hurt playing in. But
unpatriotic American fans think of it that way.
But it beats exhibition games in the Grapefruit League and the Cactus League at the very least. So that's,
of course,
something.
The great irony of this is that I'll be missing the first week of WBC play to go cover the Cactus League in person. So, you know, as big a detractor of spring training as I am and as big a fan of WBC, the job gets in the way sometimes.
Yeah. Well, in the second half of this episode, we will discuss the WBC. We're going to talk to Octavio Hernandez, who is a Venezuelan journalist who has been doing some advanced scouting for the WBC. But before we get to him, we're going to talk about some rules and some rule benders. Just recently, MLB has added and clarified some new rules for the 2017 season, and a couple of these rules seem prompted by particular players. There's one that David Price seems to have been the impetus for, and it's about clarifying your delivery. Are you pitching from the stretch or from the windup, particularly with a runner on third? Pitchers now have to say something so that umpires know when to call a balk, not that they ever know when to call a balk anyway, but supposedly that is colloquially being called the David Price rule, and then more prominently, the so-called Carter Capps rule against the Padres reliever who has a hop in his delivery. And this addition to Rule 5.07 says that a pitcher may not take a second step toward home plate with either foot or otherwise reset his pivot foot in his delivery of the pitch. It seems as if Capps's old delivery will continue to be legal. There was some question about whether he was adding a second hop in spring training this year, or whether that was just something that he was doing in one of his early bullpen sessions. Anyway, it seems to have been prompted by Capps and seems to make some sense. You'd want to have some rule against pitchers just taking an indefinite number of hops. Someone could hop all the way to home plate. So now pitchers can't do that. And we wanted to talk to our historical consultant, Stephen Goldman, who's been on the show before. He is a columnist for Vice Sports and Today's Knuckleball, formerly of Baseball Prospectus and SB Nation and other sites, and also a biographer of Casey Stengel. Hello, Stephen.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah. So we want to talk about other rule changes that have been prompted by particular players. But before we get into that, do you have any thoughts on the delivery and how that came to be codified?
I think the Capps delivery is fascinating because, like you said, it's just maybe a second hop, but you can kind of imagine the Olympic triple jump, you know, kind of working its way into the pitcher's delivery. And the reason for that The reason that this would be a problem is obviously the closer to the mound, to the home plate that a pitcher is, the more his stuff will play up. I mean, the fastball doesn't have as much of a distance to cross, or a curveball will break differently. Actually, it breaks better from further away, as it turns out, which is something that baseball found over 100 years ago when it went to this distance. And the reason that they went to this distance was pitchers were dominating and strikeouts were getting too high. And what they had begun with was not a pitcher's mound so much as a box. And initially, they could do whatever they wanted within that box, as long as they finished within the box. So you had this space that was, by the time they did away with it in favor of the current pitcher's mound, was about 5.5 feet long. And you could run around in that box or not necessarily face directly at the hitter or do kind of whatever you wanted. Some deliveries were restricted. You know, guys were more throwing underhand at that point. But eventually, as strikeouts got to be more dominant, they kept moving the pitcher back to the present dimension. And since then, people have been trying to cheat those dimensions or shorten those dimensions in different ways. And sometimes that comes naturally, like when you have a pitcher like Randy Johnson, who's 6'11". So by the time he finishes his windup, he's covered half the distance to home plate anyway, which, as we saw, was very frightening for some batters. And then on the other end, there was a really famous incident during the ill-fated managerial term of Maury Wills with the Mariners, which happened about 1980. He sort of straddled the 80 and 81 seasons, where the A's came in with a pitcher named Rick Lankford, who was very good for a while until Billy Martin pitched his arm off. And he threw these big breaking balls. And so Maury Wills had the idea that you'd have the grounds crew extend the batter's box out towards the mound a little bit so that his hitters could cheat forward and catch that curveball before it broke and hit it into the seats. Unfortunately, Billy Martin had already thought of that and spotted it because, you know, there was no rule you could break that he hadn't thought about breaking already. And so Maury Wills got ejected. The boxes were redrawn. And I assume Lankford went on and pitched some fine games against the Mariners.
We wanted to talk to you because often rule changes will be prompted by some larger development. There will be a big change in the run environment that's driven by the league as a whole, and then baseball will have to respond to that. But we're interested in these cases where an individual player or person or event necessitated a rule change because someone did something differently and got away with it, and it became clear to everyone, oh, this is not good. This is a loophole. We don't want people exploiting this. And so we better get a rule on the books to prevent this from happening again. So Caps seems like a good example of that. And we'll see whether he actually can hold himself to this delivery and how closely people check. You know, will people be asking the umpire to check to see if his toe is leaving a line as it drags down the mound? Will there be replay reviews to see if he's actually leaving the ground or not? I'm not sure, but
I hope not.
Yeah. We wanted to ask about other instances of this happening, because this is not the first time that we've seen a rule change prompted by particular players. So can you give us any examples that come to mind?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right that sometimes the rules are the result of, you know, careful deliberations by people, and certainly the adjustments of the mound and the distance between the pitcher's rubber and home plate that I talked about a moment ago. Those were things that people debated for a long time and were decided in committee. But a lot of other things are contingent, and they, like you said, they just come up because somebody does something and you think, oh, we hadn't thought of that before. Like, you know, in the 1800s, Cap Anson deciding to be really annoying and just deciding to switch hit during pitches. So that, you know, this sounds like a really good way to get killed, actually, especially in an era before helmets, because you'd think that if the pitcher timed it just right, you'd have your head standing in over home plate as the ball came in. But he would do this. He'd get in one batter's box and then flip around. And that was outlawed. Another one from that period, or a little bit later, you get different dates on this, but somewhere, let's say about 1910, there was a player named Germany Schaefer, who was known as kind of a wacky guy. And he is probably best remembered today for stealing first base. And the idea behind that, if you haven't heard this story too many times, was that there was a runner on third in the bottom of the ninth with less than two outs. And Schaefer was on first. And what he was hoping to do, I guess he didn't have a lot of confidence in the batter at the plate delivering the game-winning hit. What he was hoping to do is run towards second and, you know, set off the double steal, but either get caught in a rundown or cause the overthrow so the runner could just walk home. And what happened was that he went to second without drawing a throw, which didn't serve his purposes at all. Now there were runners on second and third, and that, you know, his run was completely superfluous. So wanting to reenact, to recreate the scenario wherein the rundown could happen, he then on the next pitch stole first base so he could steal second again. Ultimately, he was caught stealing doing that, so the whole thing was rather moot. But ultimately, they outlawed that. That's one very famous example. Mm-hmm.
So some of these rule changes are, the eponymous rule seems to happen more in hockey. Like I remember the Sean Avery rule where he was standing in front of the goalie on the power play, waving his stick in front of the goalie's face with his back to the play, and the NHL came down the next day and pretty much said, this is bullshit, you can't do that anymore. But the Carter Capps thing and the Germany Schaefer stealing first base are like obvious, whereas other stuff, like I think of the late Justin Miller, who had to wear long sleeves on the mound to cover up his tattoos, or there was a thing a couple years ago where a couple Nationals pitchers had to have the laces on their gloves trimmed to so as not to interfere with replay. Like, does the glove lace count as part of the glove for purposes of applying a tag? So like the David Price rule, as inscrutable as it is, just sort of feels like we're just doing this to do it.
Well, let's talk about that, because the thing you mentioned in hockey, for example, is reminiscent of a guy named Eddie Stanky, who used to play with the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 40s and 50s. And he was not a guy who was incredibly talented in terms of, you know, hitting ability. He wasn't Jose Altuve, but what he had, he milked the hell out of. And one of the ways he did that is by being annoying. His nickname was the Brat. So, for example, he got into the habit of, you know, when playing second base, as the pitcher was about to deliver, he would just sort of break into jumping jacks or semaphore type motions in order to distract the batter. So that was outlawed right away. Another thing he liked to do that is actually kind of a great idea if you think about it, and this was outlawed as being contrary to the rule. If he was on third in a sacrifice fly situation, he would line up way behind the bag. And again, this is another thing, kind of like the Cap Anson thing, where you'd think you would screw it up more times than it worked right. But as the ball was hit to the outfield, he would take off at a run so that his foot hit the bag as if he were tagging as the ball was caught, but he's already in motion. So as opposed to taking off from a stationary position of tagging up, he's flying down home plate and you could never catch him at home. So that was outlawed. Another example, and you brought this up with the laces and the mitts and stuff, the uniform that sounds redundant, but you know that everybody's uniform has to be identical, is another thing that goes back to about the 1890s, and it hasn't always been consistently enforced, but it used to be a thing that managers really looked at and would call you on it. But the leagues didn't have consistent rules about this. So it's something that's always actually confused me, because in the 20s and 30s, the Brooklyn Dodgers, again, it's just coincidence that they happen to be coming up a lot, had this Hall of Fame pitcher ultimately named Dazzy Vance. And Dazzy pitched out of a tattered shirt sleeve, and he had great stuff to begin with. So if you can imagine the hardest thrower in baseball, whoever that is right now, you know, let's, you know, say, you know, Craig Kimbrell or Aldis Chapman or somebody, you know, who's throwing, you know, relative to the league 100 miles an hour, has also sliced his sleeve open. So you just see this swirl of material coming at you. For some reason, that was legal in the National League. You, like, managers would protest this, but Dazzy Vance got away with it his whole career. A few years later in the American League in 1938, there was a pitcher named Johnny Allen, who is not well remembered today, but for a short period of time was just about like the most effective pitcher in the American League for a while, just like would have these incredible records of, you know, like, you know, 19-1 or 20-1, those kinds of things. And he was able to do that for a little while. And what's parenthetically, what's super wonderful about that is that he wasn't scouted. He was the bellboy for the Yankees' main scout, Paul Critchell, and just happened to say, as he was carrying up his luggage, "By the way, I can pitch a little bit." And I'm sure even today scouts hear that a lot, but Critchell listened to him and it turned out, yeah, he could pitch a bit. So, and he became this really successful pitcher. The thing was, he had this ridiculous anger management problem and tended to try to choke umpires to death if he didn't like the calls and things like that. Well, anyway, this was one of those situations where he decided that he would pitch out of a tattered shirt sleeve, and This time in the American League, the umpires called him on it, insisted he remove the shirt. He went nuclear, got thrown out of the game. The shirt wound up in the Hall of Fame. The pitcher didn't. But anyway, I mean, this is a thing that goes right down to this day. Like, I can remember back maybe 10 is it over 10 years ago, maybe at this point, but when Arthur Rhodes was with the Orioles as a lefty specialist.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he had so much jewelry. And I mean, he looked like he had just walked out of an Egyptian tomb, you know, with he had so much ornamentation on him. And Joe Torre called him on it one time and he had a complete meltdown. And it bothered me in the sense that this was entirely fair gamesmanship in terms of baseball, in terms of calling that rule into play, but they should have done it every single time that Rhodes pitched. Every manager should have done it every single time Rhodes pitched, because if he temperamentally couldn't deal with that, then that's a competitive advantage to take advantage of within the space of the rules. But I guess that kind of gamesmanship has gone out of fashion.
And you mentioned when we were emailing Satchel Paige, who seems like another guy who experimented with a lot of pitching styles, and I'm surprised that he didn't try the Carter Capps delivery at some point.
Well, he kind of did.
Yeah.
the thing about Satchel Paige is, of course, he was ageless and mm-hmm. and pitched forever and pitched probably more games than anybody. And of course, like all pitchers, his arm eventually fell off and he didn't have the same stuff that he had when he was young in the Negro Leagues by the time the color line was broken and he got up to the American League. But what he had was ridiculous command. And, you know, they said he could throw the ball over a dime on home plate. And Bill Veeck would tell the story of him auditioning for Lou Boudreau, that they folded a handkerchief over, you know, and stuck it in the middle of home plate. And he kept throwing the ball over the handkerchief. So he not only had that kind of command, he had a variety of deliveries. He could drop down sidearm. And he had for a while what he called the hesitation pitch. And the way that it worked was, it was kind of, the intention was almost like a changeup, except that a changeup Bugs Bunny style, where you never actually would deliver the ball. So he would wind up, and if you've seen pictures of Satchel Paige pitching, he had a big leg kick and huge feet. And what he would do is come down with his plant leg and hold the ball somehow an extra moment so that the batter would see the plant leg come down and the shoulders start to rotate forward and would swing at that motion. And then he would throw the ball. So it's a matter of very close timing, but it's almost as if, you know, you're torturing your little brother or little sister, like pretending to throw something at them. Go, psych, yeah. Psych, psych.
I do that with my dog and her like little thing that she plays fetch with.
I was afraid you were going to say her fiance, but I'm glad that in fact it's not, because that really wouldn't bode well. But he would do that, and the American League said, yeah, you can't, you know, if you're going to pitch, you got to pitch. It's a balk otherwise.
Mm-hmm. So, like, I guess part of the reason we don't see controversies like this is, like, a lot of these issues, I guess, have already been mined. But is there, like, I guess, would it be considered Bush to do something like that? Or is there, like, a normative impetus not to push the boundaries in a way that Eddie Stanky might have?
I think partially. I mean, I think there are always players who are going to be willing to try that. I mean, I don't know if you guys remember this, but Ricky Henderson one time, and he's like, you need a personality like his, I think, to get around the kind of, like you said, shame that comes with trying to innovate or trying to bend the rules and being caught. And there was an occasion where he misread the number of outs, I think, and was running from first to third on a fly ball, and the ball was caught. He didn't realize that there were less than two outs, so he had to get back to first. There was no hope that he was going to, as fast as Ricky Henderson was, going to be able to retouch second and then go back to first. So he simply cut across the pitcher's mound and stood on first base, and nobody was fooled by that. It was a sort of a big laugh for everybody. But I mean, if you're Ricky Henderson, you can get away with that because people think you're kind of nuts to begin with. You're going to need players like that who are kind of bold and hope they'll get away with it. But otherwise, yeah, I think, you know, this game has been played in various forms for, a couple of hundred years at least. And then, you know, in an organized form going back to the mid 19th century. So a lot of these things people have tried and they've been legislated out. And, you know, I wouldn't say never, because there's an infinity of situations that we haven't seen and haven't thought of yet. But a lot of it has been regimented over the course of time.
Yeah. And I guess this has probably happened on the management side too, where you get things like Scott Boras and the draft loophole he found in 1996. And then that happens and you can exploit it once and then it gets closed. Or Bill Veeck would write about things that he tried that were then immediately outlawed. I don't know if he was telling tall tales about things like movable fences or not, but he would claim to have tried them and then he'd get a cease and desist letter from the league basically the next day. So
speaking of which, Eddie Goodell, like they outlawed Eddie Goodell, but his uniform number 1/8 would be to this day totally legal in Major League Baseball. There's nothing in the rule book that says that your uniform number has to be an integer.
Okay, so that's still an exploitable.
Yeah, there's no competitive advantage to that, but it's. Yeah.
You know, you'd expect that these things would be rarer now. You're mentioning 19th century examples, and it's impressive that people like Carter Capps and maybe David Price are still finding ways to sort of bend the rules in a sport that's been around for going on 200 years now. So I don't know how much else there is out there to try to find these edges here and there, but I like that people are still finding them, that we're still having to close these little loopholes that various players are finding. I don't know if you had any other examples in mind or things that fit roughly into this category that you want to mention before we wrap up?
Yeah, one other one, and this is also famous, and it's a good example of unintended consequences, which is the pine tar rule with George Brett in 1983. And the rule was that you could put anything you wanted on the handle of your bat pretty much to improve the grip, as long as it didn't extend up to 18 inches from the fat end of the bat, the barrel. And this rule had been on the books for a long time, and no one exactly knew why, because having pine tar does help you grip the bat, but it's not going to change the way that you hit the ball. I mean, if the pitcher has it, it's going to change something because it's tacky. It's going to change his grip, but it's not going to do anything in terms of what the batter does if he hits the ball with a barrel that has pine tar on it. And possibly the owners just wanted to save money on pine tar by not having their players indiscriminately goop it all over the place. So it's one of these silly rules that batters had indeed been called out on it many times before July 1983, when George Brett crushes his home run, and the Yankees had been lying in wait for him on that. They had noticed just how much pine tar he was using, and they got the call on it. And then both the American League and the Commissioner of Baseball said, you know, this is kind of silly. We can negate a home run on something that has no point. And they allowed the game to be replayed. It didn't have any huge impact on things, as it turned out. And the Yankees treated it like a joke and put pitcher Ron Guidry in center field and stuff like that. But when you do this thing, like, you know, like Michael talked about the David Price rule, you get these unintended consequences. And, you know, right before we went on, I was talking about 1988, where they last tried to refine the balk rule and suddenly pitchers were balking every other pitch, and they had to suspend that midseason because it got kind of silly, the degree to which balks were being called. So what we don't know with any of these changes, and it's hard to imagine, say, like, you know, holding up four fingers for an intentional walk will change anything dramatically, or that the Carter Capps rule will change anything dramatically. But you don't know. And until we see them played out in several hundred games, you won't really be able to tell what the alterations will really mean.
All right. Well, you can read Steven's column to be named later at FanRag Sports a couple times a week. You can find him on Twitter at GoStephenGoldman. Steve, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. We'll be right back with Octavio Hernandez to talk about the WBC. Okay, so we are joined now by Octavio Hernandez, who until recently was working on advanced scouting for the Venezuelan WBC team, and he's a baseball writer coming to us from Caracas. Hey, Octavio, how are you?
Very good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, happy to. So could you tell us a little bit briefly about your background, how you got into baseball and how you got involved with the WBC?
Okay. Around 9 years ago, I moved to Caracas. I'm from Puerto La Cruz. That's like a coast city here in Venezuela. And I got a job in a major national newspaper called Líder. Mm-hmm. I started to work as a beat writer. I chased for 4 years the Tigres de Aragua team. That was the Miguel Cabrera's team here over here in our winter league. Mm-hmm. And I chased 2 years the Navegantes del Magallanes, That's like one of the two biggest teams here in Venezuela. And well, I worked there until 2014. Since then, I've been working as a columnist, as an analyst, and as a consultant for several teams here. And around August, a friend of mine, a scout called Oscar Prieto Rojas, called me, and he was working side by side with Carlos Guillen, who is the GM for the Venezuelan team in the WBC. And he told me that he needed someone to make some profiles to give the coaching staff, so the advanced scouting department had a little bit of pitch effects and trackman stats. There aren't very too much people here in Venezuela who know how to work with Baseball Savant and Brooks Baseball and Fangraphs and stuff like that. So I said yes. I worked for them for 6 months, trying to doing some profiles of our probable rivals. That was a tough task because we didn't have an official roster until 30 days ago. So I had to like analyze every candidate. you can imagine the like 25 or 30% of the work I ended up in the trash because so many guys said yes at the beginning, but they ended up saying no because, I don't know, they wanted to stay on spring training stuff. And about 3 weeks ago, Oscar Prieto Rojas and Carlos Guillen ended up the relationship. And, I ended up outside the team. But, well, at least they have like 50% of the work that I've sent. See, I mean, it's a bittersweet sentiment because I really wanted to share this kind of information with the coaching staff and players, but my dream was to speak to the players in person and just ask them, why the hell do you throw, for example, Gianmar Gomez has a difficult time trying to tame left-hander hitters because basically he's very predictable. His sinker just goes outside and low, and his changeup is crappy. Yeah, of course, I wouldn't tell him that exactly, but I would say something like, don't you want to try something different? Don't you know that your changeup has been murdered and your sinker is really predictable? Something like that. I don't know. But, well, I won't do that for the foreseeable future. But I really believe that the opportunity will come. I don't know when, but I'm a believer.
Yeah. So give us a picture of how seriously the Venezuelan baseball community and the public at large is taking the WBC, because one of the struggles in the U.S. is just people don't care all that much. Is it different in Venezuela at all?
No, here it's like the World Cup for the FIFA World Cup. I mean, this is a major tournament. This is not the Caribbean Series. I know that in the United States, it's a tournament that is like secondary or something like that. But here, I believe that when we play Puerto Rico or Mexico, and we're seeing Felix Hernandez and Miguel Cabrera and Jose Altuve, this country's going to stop. this will be a major, major event. Like, well, the first three tournaments have been like that. And I have no doubts that the excitement and the animosity of the fanhood here in Venezuela is going to be exactly the same or even greater.
And that level of seriousness must carry on to the national federation, because I mean the USA has traditionally had a retired manager, you know, Jim Leland's coaching the team this year, but you know, Carlos Guillen is a big figure in Venezuelan baseball as a manager, and there's been controversy with him and Omar Vizquel and him leaving his Drupal Cabrera home. So like, you know, this is, yeah.
Yeah, which is just laughing because it was a pretty low point in the coordination of the whole tournament. I mean,
yeah,
those guys those guys don't even talk.
So how did that play out? I mean, again, that was a footnote, but that's, you know, you compared it to soccer, but the manager leaving a prominent player home happens all the time. It generates huge controversy. And how much press did the animosity between Guillen and Vizquel get, and the decision to leave is Drupal Cabrera?
Basically, the people took it like Carlos Guillen. I'm going to go into deep waters here because Carlos Guillen is a GM for the Tigres de Aragua, and he has like a reputation of being a little bit controversial here in our winter league. So when this happened, people said like, of course this would happen. This is Carlos Guillen we're talking about. And Omar Vizquel is like a major totem on the minds of our fanhood here in Venezuela. I mean, he's a god. Omar Vizquel, I don't know how can you explain the love that people feel for Omar Vizquel, the love and respect. So when this happened, people weren't accusing Omar of anything. In some cases, I believe that's my perception, that it was like, well, this is Carlos Guillen, and he's really controversial. This was going to happen. People were expecting something like this. But the decision that leaving Arturo Cabrera out of the team was not as controversial for the fanhood because, well, you have Alcides Escobar, and for the majority of the fans, Alcides Escobar is better or is equal than Arturo Cabrera. He has a gold glove. People really don't know that he just doesn't bat anything anymore. And he's really slow. I mean, I tried, one of my goals as when we were preparing like the comparisons, I sent a comparison between Freddy Galvis, Arturo Cabrera, and Alcides Escobar. And I basically said to them, look, if you want an offensive lineup, if you want to give an edge to the offensive part of the team, you go with Arturo Cabrera. He was very good in 2016, especially in the last 2 months. He was one of the wonders of the launch angle. He applied like the Daniel Murphy philosophy. Uh-huh. And he started pulling more the ball, and the launch angle was more productive. So there were certain stats that kind of gave foundations to his 2016 year. So I basically say to him, this guy is the best offensive guy, he has great hands, but he's a turtle over shortstop. You know what you get with him. And with Freddy Galvez, you will have the best defensive shortstop, no question about it. You'll have, well, 20 homers. Then it's really funny. That Freddy Galvez, it's just, that doesn't add up.
No, it doesn't. It absolutely does not. I've struggled to grapple with that myself. It's ridiculous that he hit 20 home runs last year.
Well, he had 20 homers, and he has the greatest hands and the greatest range of our shortstop. And I basically told them with statistics, if you want to give an edge to the defensive part of the team, well, you go with Freddy Galvez. Just to stay clear, this guy doesn't hit a breaking ball from the righties by a miracle. He had like the sliders from right-hander pitching were killing him. And he doesn't have discipline on the plate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And well, when they gave the opportunity to Alcides Escobar or those two guys, people didn't know this. They didn't know, well, obviously we're bringing the third best shortstop, and this is all Carlos Guillen or someone else's fault, and this is a crappy move. People are not seeing that. People are seeing, well, this is Alcides Escobar. He's a world champion. He has a gold glove, and he's really good. He's comparable. And well, stats don't agree.
Were there any other players you were hoping that the team would get that they weren't able to get, or they decided not to get?
Pitchers. Felipe Rivero, I'm in love with that guy. Felipe Rivero, he's a lefty from the Pirates. He throws 97. He's a nasty changeup, a nasty slider. I mean, he has it all. Luis Avilán, a lefty from the Dodgers. He has a nasty sinker. He's not a loogie. He can control righties and lefties. And Miguel Sokolovich was a pretty personal blow because this is Miguel Sokolovich is a right-hander for the St. Louis Cardinals. He has pitched only 20 innings on MLB in 2016 and 2015, but he has a superb command, and he has a great slider for righties, a great changeup for lefties, and he has it all, but he has a fastball of 92, so basically no one cares about it. And so those three guys, and Eduardo Ramos, well, of course, Carlos Carrasco was the greatest blow for the team. Carlos Carrasco and Junior Guerra, those guys were basically 1-2 on my mind because, well, those, I mean, Junior Guerra has, I believe, exhibited a better stuff than even Felix Hernandez in 2016. He had 95 miles per hour fastball, a pretty great splitter, and he was very controlled guy. And Carlos Carrasco is just a wonder. Mm-hmm. But well, they say no. Understandably, I believe so.
Right. Well, do you think it's easier for teams other than the U.S. team to recruit players just because it is a bigger deal in their home countries? Or do you think it doesn't really matter because they're focused on their major league teams, which is understandable?
I think it doesn't matter. But the thing is about the United States and Dominican Republic, they have this great vast of resource.
Right.
I mean, if one says no, they have another. They have plan B, a plan C, a plan D. Mm-hmm. Venezuela has a plan A, a plan B, and maybe a plan C, but the depth of the roster is not comparable to the United States. I mean, United States are not bringing Mike Trout, Bryce Harper, Noah Syndergaard, Max Scherzer, and you can hardly even tell because when you look, you look at that lineup, it's a huge. It's an all-star lineup, and you look at the depth of the pitching staff, and it's great. That's not going to happen for Venezuela. Mm-hmm. There's one guy that you could take a look. Venezuela is gonna bring a guy called Robert Suarez. This guy has 21 years old. He pitches in the MPB, and he has the second best fastball in the whole MPB. Hmm. It was it's kind of cool. Of course, Shohei Ohtani topped him,
right?
But yeah, it's only natural. But this guy is a reliever. Has 5 pitches, like all the pitchers that go into Japan. And we will see him for the first time here in Venezuela, because we don't watch MPB ever. We will see him for the first time here in the World Baseball Classic. And this will be a really cool moment, not only for that young talent, but for the people that brought him in. Because when they were selecting the roster, some people told me, you should look at Robert Suarez. And I went to, there's a webpage like Beta Fan Graphs on Japan. It's called Delta Graphs. Mm-hmm. So you can search in there. It's pretty much like Fan Graphs on 2018 and 2008, 2007. You can check the velocity and basic stuff from Pitch FX. And well, this guy had like the 6th greatest swing and strike percentage. He had a killer slider. He had a really great profile, and he has a 96 mile per hour fastball. So it's pretty cool. I'm really excited to at least watch him that guy pitch, because I haven't seen him like in live baseball.
Well, so based on the preparation you did for Venezuela's immediate competitors and based on what you think of their own roster, how does Venezuela's team compare? How big is the gap between the U.S. and the Dominican and Venezuela? How much better are other teams, and how good a chance does Venezuela have?
Well, the Vegas odds puts them at 10% chance.
Yeah.
And it sounds kind of like the odds I would give, because of course they will have a killer lineup. They will have a killer defensive chart. You'll have Ender Inciarte in on center field. You will have Salvador Perez in on the catching position. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have Jose Altuve. He's a, like, maybe average, but of course he's a great. I mean, the lineup is going to be great, and the defensive part is going to be great. The pitching staff, that's not going to be like MLB all-star. I mean, you will have, well, Francisco Rodriguez is in doubt. I read 24 hours ago that he was suffering from something, and he's thinking not to pitch him with Venezuela. That would be another huge loss for the team, because they have basically Bruce Rondon for the eighth. They have Robert Suarez. They don't have like the bullpen A and B that you were projecting 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. And on the starting pitching, you won't have Carlos Carrasco, and you won't have Junior Guerra. You instead will have Felix Hernandez. You have Martin Perez. That Martin Perez is not a great matchup against a righty lineup of U.S. That sinker is going to be really punished. And you'll have Eduardo Rodriguez. That is a really good option. And Yolis Chacin would be your fourth starter. And Yolis Chacin is a fringe five starter or six starter on MLB. That nearly doesn't compare to the depth that U.S. is going to put on the table. But then again, the WBC has been won by Japan two times. Cuba beat the hell out of us in the third tournament. South Korea just humiliated us. So it's a weird tournament. I mean, people go there; they are they're not in the best shapes of their lives. And it's a short tournament. I mean, you have to win 7 games in a row, basically, to not 7, but 10 games in a row to be the champion. And it's not like a season. If you put this team on a 162 game season against the US and the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico and Mexico, I truly believe that Venezuela would have the third spot in that division. I mean, I think this team is better than the team that Puerto Rico has, and it's better than the team that Mexico has. Mm-hmm. Imagining this, I don't know, this imaginary division. Of course, the United States would won like 115 games or something like that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And if you had one tip or one scouting insight that you learned during all of your research, like, is there a specific player on one of Venezuela's opponents that you have in your mind, don't throw this pitch to that guy, or do throw this pitch to that guy? Do you have any top recommendations?
You read my mind. this is my dream. I mean, I wrote to Eduardo Perez, the bench coach, basically saying to him, please tell Felix Hernandez that doesn't throw as often his sinker against Puerto Rico. Those guys eat for breakfast sinkers. Carlos Beltran is just a monster against sinkers. And Felix has 4 pitches. He has a curveball that throws about 20% of the time. And we know that curveball is in fashion right now. You have guys like Rich Hill throwing it like 48% of the time, but Lance McCullers at 43% of the time. So why the hell Felix can't throw that in 30% of the time in a World Baseball Classic? Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be a really good advice. Carlos Beltran, it's not a great hitter against curveballs. Yadier Molina is not a great hitter against curveballs. I mean, that lineup is Felix Hernandez is one of the pitchers that lives in the low zone of the strike zone. Mm-hmm. I mean, every single pitch that he throws is at the knees or something like that. If he could throw a curveball in the middle part of the plate, just like a show me pitch instead of a sinker, just like Rich Hill does. Rich Hill attacks the zone in the middle of the upper part of the zone with a lot of curveballs. Maybe he wouldn't get murdered as often as he has been in the last couple of years, specifically with his sinker. His sinker in 2016 was like 0.650 on slugging. I mean, people would just murder that pitch. So that would be my instant recommendation. And of course, Felix would slap my face instantly when I said that to him.
All right. Well, we wish you luck. We will enjoy the tournament and hope that Venezuela has something to celebrate. You can find Octavio on Twitter, tweeting about the tournament, I'm sure, at Octavio Lider. Thank you, Octavio.
No, it was a pleasure. Really, I'm a big fan of your work, Ben, and Michael. It was an honor to share with you this minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
All right, that's it for this week's show. Until next week, enjoy spring training responsibly. We'll talk to you then.